So a lot of people interested in the Joe Mixon lawsuit story, as I would suspect.
Yes, it's fascinating.
I told you, people forgot about that situation. And
so just to lay it all out, everybody, there was a shooting at Joe Mixon's house a couple of years back, 2023, where it was somebody in Joe Mixon's house. His name's Lamonte Brewer. He's the boyfriend of Joe Mixon's girlfriend. Shot a teenager in Joe Mixon's backyard who was engaged in a game of Nerf Wars, just presumably running around, you know, shooting their buddies with Nerf guns and what have you. At some point, Mixon's girlfriend had run in screaming, telling the kids to get into the room and lock the door. And then Lamonte went out and took care of business and shot one of these kids who was holding the Nerf gun that is like looks like a Nerf gun. It's a gray. It's blue. There's a bright blue. There's bright green and light plastic. It's grayer than your average. It's like a bright orange fake gun. So depending on whether it happened at night or not, I suppose I could maybe see some of the reason for confusion.
That would
it did happen at night, yeah.
That would be the prerequisite for even this to be, you know, at first mistaken for something nefarious and, like, more serious going on outside of, like, kids shooting themselves with Nerf guns.
This the Lamonte Brewer, the actual shooter, this could have been a real tragedy. He went out and fired 10 to 11 shots at the teens who were playing Nerf Wars that night and hit one of them in the foot. Just spraying bullets like crazy out there, apparently.
Wild. Somebody texted in from the 832. That happened in my neighborhood a few weeks ago. Those kids are going into people's fenced backyards and hiding, and some homeowners think they're burglars about to break in. Very dangerous for kids to do. Yes, most definitely. Like that. That's taking it to a different level. And then, you know, you're doing that on somebody else's property. So you're opening yourself up for exactly.
I would advise you not to. I don't know. When we were kids in a development, you do that. You run around, you play. Everybody's backyard was it was basically like free range in where we grew up. And I think in Houston where you got more. This was in Cincinnati, obviously. but I'm giving advice to kids in Houston. Things have changed a lot. Yeah. People are at heightened alert. They've been watching true crime documentaries at 8 hours a day for the last 20 years. And it's just a different time. You got to be careful. You can't just go traipsing around people's backyards.
All right. I meant to get to this at the time, but I didn't want to interrupt you. But a texter heard the same thing that I heard. And I imagine you meant to say brother, but texter from the 713 says, did Seth just say the guy was the boyfriend of Joe Mixon's girlfriend?
That's... Oh, no. Yeah, go ahead. Joe Mixon.
He said that sounds Mixon's... like the most interesting part of the story.
Joe Mixon's sister. Yeah. Lamonte Brewer, who is the boyfriend of Joe Mixon's sister at the time. Okay. He ended up getting sentenced. So there was a lawsuit. So there was a lawsuit because Joe Mixon's a property owner and they argued that he supplied either the ammunition or the firearm itself. I'm not sure. So that was settled. That was the news this morning, was that lawsuit was settled. Just like you, Sean, I had completely forgotten about this.
Yeah.
Because I knew it didn't involve Joe Mixon himself. So I guess it just didn't. I didn't think it was ever going to end up being anything scandalous or anything.
Yeah, good question. And then we'll move on from the text line. Why weren't the kids charged with trespassing? Why did Joe Mixon end up having to write a check? And just to clarify, from my end, it looks like Joe Mixon wrote a check. But you know, Mike Florio points out, who understands these things, like it might look like Joe Mixon just wrote a check and made this thing go away, but the check per se probably came from the homeowner's insurance policy.
Yeah, and there's also the kids' parents had argued that the kids had actually talked to... I could totally... They had talked to Joe Mixon before any of this actually happened.
Yeah.
So it could be a situation where Joe Mixon was aware of what the kids were doing, but his sister and her boyfriend were not. And just obviously a near-awful occurrence, but a near-tragic occurrence.
Tragedy evaded, yes. 713-572-4610 if you'd like to weigh in on the text line. Join us on the chats, Twitch, and YouTube. All the Rockets do is hit dingers, Seth. You know, it's been a pretty awesome week or so for Houston this offseason. You pick up Kevin Durant. You're continuing to add the necessary pieces around him in some areas that the Rockets were obviously lacking last season. And for the immediate, upon dealing for Kevin Durant, for the Phoenix Suns and shipping Dylan Brooks out particularly, you needed a 3-and-D guy. They went out and got Dorian Finney-Smith, and you know, we'll see what else is on tap for them. But this offseason, I think I mentioned to you earlier this morning, is the vibe that I'm getting has made Rocket fans feel very similar to the way that I think Texan fans felt last offseason for them, when you picked up some big pieces as well. Joe Mixon, Azeez Alshire, Stephon Diggs. You really looked like you were building to win right now. And we were talking Super Bowl. Like, hey, maybe this is a Super Bowl team for the Texans last year. I think people are absolutely anticipating making a real legitimate run through the Oklahoma City Thunder and thinking title contending Rockets in 25-26.
Yeah, I think there's another similarity there too that you got to be on the watch for, which is that with the Texans, what I said all last offseason was that Bobby Slowick is promising as an offensive coordinator, but he still has to prove that he's a genuinely good offensive coordinator. The run game was not what it needed to be for running that type of offense.
Yeah.
And then Bobby Slowick failed abysmally in that regard. So I guess the next question is, all right, yes, they have the pieces in place. Kevin Durant should make the offense a whole lot better. But the questions about Udoka engineering that offense and getting that offensive performance out of the entire team, not just the addition of Kevin Durant, I guess that's the big question, to where you got to actually see it play out on the court. Looks awesome on paper right now, but they actually got to, they obviously have to perform.
I always like to feel validated, by guys that cover the NBA, in this particular case, Zach Lowe, when they view these moves exactly as I do. And you and I do. Like, we love this offseason. Rocket fans love this offseason. It's like they could do no wrong. Well, NBA writer Zach Lowe's been covering the association for a long time. On his podcast yesterday, co-signed all of that.
They clearly, I think, are going as far in as any team can be on playing two centers together. They believe in the Şengün Adams magic that happened last year. I assume Capella will fit into that and allow them to load manage Adams for the year. And they just have, like, Finney-Smith is not as well equipped to defend like point guards as he is to defend bigger wings. They have guys who can defend point guards for him, like Amen Thompson and Fred VanVleet and maybe Tari Eason. You can quibble with, like, are they almost, I don't know if there's such a thing as being too big, actually, when they're this fast and this athletic. I think this team, between the Rockets and what the Nuggets did, and I talked with Waz about that, I think they come in 2-3 in the West with a bullet right now. I have no criticism of the Rockets offseason. I think it's been a home run all the way around.
Love that. And the thing that reminded me of something that you'd said yesterday, Seth, that we talked about, is when Zach Lowe was talking about the pairing of Steven Adams and Clint Capella, you know, behind Alperen Şengün, is he didn't seem at all miffed about that front court trio of Şengün, Adams, and Capella and how that whole dynamic's going to work. We talked about, you bring in Capella, one, you're getting cheaper if you're assumingly replacing him, Jock Landale's position with Clint Capella. You're getting $1 million a season cheaper and more productive in the amount of minutes played, certainly for Capella, who's on the downside of his career. But it's very much about a load-managing situation for Steven Adams, who, once healthy last season, was a huge contributor.
Yeah, and so there is that part. And with Steven Adams, we still don't know exactly. He's still relatively young. He's a big man. They don't age as well. But he'll be 32 this season. And like, his minutes were reduced and his load had to be managed partly because he was just coming off of that injury. So if he gets back up to a guy who's 25 minutes a night, you're still going to load manage him as an older big man. But I think really it's also an indication of, as they're load managing Steven Adams, I think they're really going to lean into the two big man lineup because having Kevin Durant on the floor changes some things in a way that allows you to, you know, allows you to deal with some of the issues that come with having two big men out there, all the spacing issues that it provides, so that in specific matchups that, you're going to see more of that. Because it's always tempting when you see a lineup like that where the plus minus is so drastic to think, well, why don't they just run it all the time? Because there's weaknesses with it. There's fewer weaknesses when you've got Durant out on the floor.
I'm just spitballing here. It's hard for me to think back. I mean, Durant's been in the league a long time, right? He's going to be 37 in September. He's played with a lot of different teams. From a personnel standpoint in particular is where I'm going. This might be a first for Kevin Durant, or at least the first in a long time for Kevin Durant in the NBA, right? Because I'm thinking, go back to when he was with Oklahoma City. He had Russell Westbrook and James Harden. Now, James Harden was a sixth man in Oklahoma City, but you could see, you know, this is a budding star here. I mean, he was on the court for Oklahoma City when they were making their runs through the Western Conference. He was on the floor in critical moments in the fourth quarter, okay? And then his legend continued to grow here, obviously, as a Houston Rocket. But played with some two really great players in Oklahoma City. Then, obviously, he goes to Golden State, and he's with Klay Thompson and Steph Curry. And he, you know, rounded out that trio. Brooklyn situation obviously didn't work out, but it's Kyrie Irving, James Harden, and himself, Kevin Durant, now in Phoenix, another paired with another elite scorer with Devin Booker. He's coming to a Houston Rockets team where it's not a bunch of guys that you don't know, but from an objective standpoint, like the rest of the NBA looking at the Houston Rockets, they're thinking like, damn, this team won 50-plus games. Dang, they took the Warriors to, you know, seven in the first round this last year. Alpi, yeah, I know Alpi. Amen, yeah, he could be really good. But there's not like that all-star, you know, perennial all-star superstar player that you're pairing Kevin Durant with right now. Is this the first time where Kevin Durant, albeit like elder stage of his NBA career, is really kind of joining up with, you know, some good young budding talent that we don't really know what he's going to do for them? Great players help other players like elevate their games.
Yeah.
How much does Jabari, does Amin, does Alpi, you know, elevate their games?
Well, yeah, I think in a lot of ways.
That's the TBD.
And Fred VanVleet is a big part of that too. I think a lot of the things that they like about Fred VanVleet weren't reflected in his stats last year. But the ability to have that option of Kevin Durant and some of the decision-making and some of the opportunities that he's going to be able to actually utilize or exploit, that should be different. No matter what his individual stat line looks like, I think his ability to really direct flow and be part of a more advanced offense, you're going to see the best version of that. Like, there's a reason Udoka likes Fred VanVleet as much as he does. That's one where I think it's easy to throw the stats out a little bit.
Yeah, good point. You know, I was listening to, I think, Albert Breer. Does he do Pat McAfee show, I think, sometime?
Probably.
I was watching a lot of stuff yesterday afternoon. He was either on Pat McAfee or he was on Dan Patrick, one of the two. But point remains is that Albert Breer was talking about, a team in the NFL, the Commanders. He was talking about the Commanders. And they were saying, like, well, Terry McLaurin, you know, what's he going to do? Is he going to stay with Washington? Is he going to go somewhere else? And why would he go somewhere else? Because, dang, he's got a pretty good in Washington with Jaden Daniels. They don't really have a guy, right? It's like, there's Jaden Daniels. Like, who's their really star receiver, you know, if he stays or if he goes? And Albert Breer said, you know, there's a lot of teams in the NFL right now like that with young quarterbacks, you know, that are showing some promise and maybe teams that have a future in that, you know, you don't know these guys' names yet. But if you've got the franchise quarterback in this case, like, now it's kind of on them to kind of elevate others' play, you know, help them elevate, their games. And I'm thinking about it similarly to the Rockets and Kevin Durant. Like, you've got this guy that you feel like is the straw that you've been missing, now that can stir the drink, that's going to take you to the next level. And it's not necessarily on him, but de facto, because he is a Hall of Famer, because he is one of the greatest to ever play this game and is still doing it at a very high level, he's going to come in and by proxy, he should elevate Şengün and Jhumbari. And you don't know the best that you're going to get out of those guys yet. You know what you think you've seen so far. It's pretty good, and they're young, and you like the promise, but it could be really good with Kevin Durant.
That's where I think, you know, without having to be a vocal speech giver or leader or anything like that, a lot of times the value and effect of a veteran player like Durant is just in the pressure you feel as a younger player to actually live up to his level or his expectations. Like Şengün. Şengün showed a lot of progress in the play. In that Warriors series, he learned just kind of how to stand up and be a man, and that he was going to have to, he was going to have to do something when Draymond Green decided to buckle up on him. But like, there's more of that when you're on the floor with Kevin Durant. Let's say Kevin Durant slips a beautiful entry pass to Şengün and he does nothing with it. That's not acceptable, you know? When it's Kevin Durant giving you the dirty look or just understanding that you're letting him down, there's a powerful effect in that. I can just remember from my own experience. I remember when I was a young player with the Jaguars, and they brought Hardy Nickerson in. And Hardy Nickerson, as him playing linebacker behind you, like I was still a kid in some ways. Like, I don't want to piss that guy off. Like, I don't want to piss off. Like, Hardy Nickerson does everything the right way. If he doesn't respect me, then I'm definitely doing something wrong. So there's just almost there's an aura effect that you have with bringing in guys like that. As long as they're the right kinds of guys. Now, if they're just, if Hardy Nickerson had showed up and been just a jerk that would have been the opposite of exactly who he was. He was an awesome guy. Then maybe you don't feel that same pressure.
Yeah, well, the right kinds of guys. You could do far worse than bringing in a guy like Kevin Durant, who's got a really good relationship with your head coach in Ime Udoka, who's obviously already very demanding in many aspects and is, in that regard, very responsible for getting this team to play the way that they have defensively with that mindset. Somebody texted in from the 832. I think Kevin Durant will have an Alex Bregman-like impact as in giving out tips and wisdom to the young guys. I think that's de facto. And I think that just kind of goes along with getting to know players and the expectations. It reminds me of something that, who was it? I was listening to Lakin Tomlinson. He was on Texans All Access this week, you know, talking to the guys about like, you know, hey, I came to OTAs and I got here early because I need to get to know them and learn how to communicate with them, and they need to learn how to communicate with me. It's similar to Kevin Durant, like, yeah, you know the head coach, but you might not know very much about some of these other young players. And just over the course of a training camp or a season or, you know, even off-season get-together practices, like, that's the idea, is it's just naturally going to rub off, because when you're a 22, 23, 24-year-old player and you're getting to hoop it up all of a sudden every single day with Kevin Durant, there's going to be some things you pick up along the way. It's more so what you were kind of saying in that, yeah, I don't want to piss this guy off. Like, I'm going to show up early. I'm going to put in the work. And it's like, there's that other coach on the floor that you don't want to disappoint. Otherwise, it's going to be a foot in your ass.
Yeah, that's like the old stories about guys that would play for the Lakers. And, you know, usually when they would talk about the effect Kobe had on him, it was one, with the way he practiced, and you saw the way he practiced. They'd say the same thing about Jordan. But then two is just guys would show up and they'd see that, oh, Kobe's out there for an hour shooting threes after practice, or Kobe's there an hour before everybody else. A young minor league pitcher told me that about Roger Clemens once. Clemens had been, this was before he was in the Astros organization, Clemens was on a rehab assignment somewhere, and this minor league pitcher was on the team. And they were like, Clemens was doing his one of his off day workouts on a stationary bike, and he's like, I've never seen a human being work this hard on a stationary bike in my life. Like, the guy was just, he looked like a maniac. He looked like an absolute maniac. He was just drenched in sweat, and this is a guy who is already an established, should be in the Hall of Fame type of player.
Yeah.
That you just, by guys seeing that and seeing guys who do it the right way, it's a lot different than when you got a team, say, with like a Charles Barkley, who's just eating an Egg McMuffin on the stationary bike on the sideline.
That was late era Charles Barkley, right?
Exactly. That's where the late era guy, though. Like, okay, this was the whole issue with Laremy Tunsil being a vet. Was when C.J. Stroud said Laremy Tunsil's a vet. He's not doing nothing extra out there.
Yeah,
that was what CJ thought of that did. That's a bad influence, man, because it's
100%.
You're telling your younger players, hey, work hard, nose to the grindstone, all of this. And you want to be able to point to veterans who do it that way. And it's really, really hard when you got a bunch of young players and the guy that's making the most money on the team and all of the rest of it that comes with it is a guy that's known as never doing nothing extra. It's bad.
Yeah, yeah, it's such a great point. Boy,
to bring it back to Durant. Durant is like the classic aging basketball player who's still playing well because he's constantly working at his game.
Yeah, I mean, hell, less than 24 hours after he became a Houston Rocket in that deal with the Suns, he's in New York City hooping it up and working on his game. And I liked a lot of the memes that went on, came off of that, by the way. People were, quote tweeting like, this is what Rocket practice is going to look like for the next 1 to 3 years. It's all Kevin Durant.
Oh, yeah.
Just shooting jumpers and stuff like that. It was kind of funny.
I feel bad for some of the Rockets players because you know how this goes. The first 2 weeks of their training camp, every single question is going to be something about, isn't it awesome having Kevin Durant on your team? Isn't Kevin Durant awesome?
Yeah.
You want to say nice things about him, but there comes a point where like, it's the 29th time you guys have asked me this question. Can we move on?
Yeah, well, please. And in the first two or three game skid during the regular season, those questions are going to turn to what's going on? Like, are there problems? Like, is the offense not meshing? Is not enough basketball to go around? What's going on?
Yeah, we get the first. I can't wait until three games into the season. Somebody grabs a random screenshot of Kevin Durant with a sour look on his face.
Yeah.
And immediately, because of one glance in a game somewhere, there's already drama in Houston. Embrace it, everybody.
And if Cam Whitmore's still a Rocket, it's going to come via him. Like, Kevin Durant's going to be looking at him. Like, I already have that image in my mind. Like, damn, Cam didn't get back on defense or, he didn't get down the court in transition on time. Like, he's slacking a little bit, man. Step your game up, 20-year-old buck. Let's go. Talking about like having the right guys, right fits and things like that. And somebody on the text line said Durant, likens him to Alex Bregman, kind of an impact. A question that was addressed yesterday via Chandler Rome in The Athletic was, how exactly are the Astros going to navigate now in the short to possibly long term without both Jeremy Peña and Yordan Alvarez? Yordan's situation with the broken hand and now the setback seems a little bit more tenuous than that of just Jeremy Peña, and his broken rib, but we'll see, right? We still need to get to that update, whenever that's to come from Dana Brown. But I bring this up because between Yordan Alvarez and Jeremy Peña, like, it's easy for us to see how the Astros are going to do this because of what Joe Espada's already shown Astro fans, within the first 85, 90 games of the season. There have been all kinds of lineups, and there's fluidity with it, because of injury and underperformance. We don't know what the hell the lineup is going to look like or the rotation is going to look like with the Rockets, really, until we get to October. But Chandler Rome said via The Athletic, Peña, who's eligible to return from the IL on July 8th, 6 days left before the All-Star break, sounds more and more like he'll be out through the break. And Dana Brown did end up saying that it's wise to pump the brakes on Peña's return being maybe a little earlier. Dubon should get most of the time at shortstop. And Espada clearly doesn't trust a guy who they called up, what was it, yesterday or 2 days ago, in Shea Whitcomb. Like, when he's called up, he's been called up like 3 or 4 times the last week and a half, 2 weeks, it feels like. And he hasn't played. He probably won't play. So Dubon's your shortstop. Myers, Altuve, Cam Smith, along with Paredes, they're going to continue in their roles and probably that order in the lineup between Paredes, Myers, Altuve, Smith, so on and so forth. That seems like the most sustainable, predictable thing, and about the only thing that Joe Espada, Dana Brown, I think, have any realm of confidence in is rolling with who you've had so far. I asked the question yesterday. Well, could they call up Bryce Matthews? That didn't happen. They called up Shea Whitcomb. He ain't going to play. He's this year's Greg Kessinger, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, the lineup for now with Paredes leading off and then Myers and Altuve. I mean, part of it is that Altuve is just, he's done really well hitting third, so there's no reason to move him there. But Paredes, when you talk about sustaining this level of success despite so many reasons the Astros shouldn't be as good as they are. Paredes at the leadoff, soaking up as many pitches as possible and really just helping. It's a race, really, to get to the Astros' bullpen versus the other team's bullpen. So one of the strengths of this team is the bullpen's been really, really good. So the quicker you can get the starting pitcher for the other team out of there, then the better chance you have. As we've seen, the Astros' record when they're leading or tied at the sixth inning or later is very, very good. So that's one of those things that's kind of on the margins. And we hear it talked about on the broadcast a lot because Paredes has seen the second most pitches in the league right now. He's been very, very good and as advertised with that. But it's so crucial right now where it's that you're going to have to get through some of these Colton Gordon performances, a Lance McCullers implosion, whatever it might be, to just make it a race, make it a battle of the bullpens. And the Astros are going to win more of those battles than that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just, don't get too wild and crazy with it. You need to get into the fifth inning at least, right? So you're not having to, empty the magazine, three nights.
But your hand is forced some of the times with these young guys. It's just, I'm not saying that's the plan and they would have gone into the season wanting to do it. It's, right now they've been really, really good in one-run games. And it doesn't feel like just random chance or luck. Because
they're 18-7 in those games.
Right. Well, yeah, but sometimes that's the stat nerds will love to tell you about the randomness of one score games. That sometimes, a lot of times it is random and it is just dumb luck. The difference with this Astros team is that because the bullpen is so good and because they've been, other than where the base is loaded, they've done a good job in clutch situations.
Yeah.
So there's substance to it. But these things that you're doing really well, like being the second best fielding team in baseball, the bullpen being what it is, Paredes' competitive appearances, those are all the things that are adding up to them being where they are. But it's precarious when you don't have Yordan Alvarez and Jeremy Peña out there.
Gosh, the dumb luck, all right? Well, I'll ask, what's more sustainable within this, the idea, the notion that, some of this could be dumb luck? 18-7 record in one-run games. That's what the Astros have after a 6-5 win last night in Colorado. All right, so there's that. They've literally scored 47% of their runs this season with two outs. Is that dumb luck? That is half of your run production coming with two outs. Why does that happen if it's dumb luck? Is there a lower sustainability factor there than winning games by one run? I would say yes, because you should be winning these games by one run. If you're in that situation, we feel very comfortable with Brian Abreu pitching an eighth inning, don't we? We feel very comfortable with Josh Hader closing games out in the ninth inning, don't we? 24 consecutive saves to start a season. I'd feel like that latter, winning games by one run is more sustainable because of those two guys at the back end of your bullpen than I would the Astros continuing to be the most clutch team in baseball with two outs and runners in scoring position.
Yeah, yeah. So with Peña, you're just right now, since you're the optimist, are you expecting all-star break and then Peña will be back?
That's the most responsible thing to do. If you're we'll see how this works out, right? If you're the Astros right now and you have built your cushion of seven games, it feels and sounds very much like you're pushing the envelope unnecessarily, without Yordan, without Jeremy Peña, we'll be fine. Well, the players are even saying that. Joe Espada is saying, we'll be fine. Guys are rolling right now. He likes the way Jake's swinging the bat. He likes the way Cam is playing in the field. And he's hot right now. Christian Walker had a three-hit game. You can enjoy two more games in Colorado for this guy to maybe beef his stats up a little bit, make you feel better about that situation. So there's that. There's no rush to bring Peña back.
Christian Walker is a gigantic headache right now. And I tried this morning.
We're just right now or last 3 months?
It's become more of a headache because he's every time he has a good performance, here we go. Okay, now we're locked in. So I just went through his splits before the show just to see if I could cherry pick. Nope, he's below 700 OPS in every different split. If I go back and cherry pick, I could probably find some stretch where he's had a good performance over the last 11 and a half games or something. But I refuse for my own sanity to believe that that can possibly be a season-long thing. This can't be that first baseman after first baseman after first baseman that we trot out there is going to play the worst of his career.
Christian Walker right now reminds me of like a closer, like Ken Giles, like a head case, right? Closers, kind of like NFL kickers, they can be head cases, a little squirrely, a little weird, you know, not stable all the time. Christian Walker has literally, you know, changed like facial hair features multiple times this season. He went with the beard, the mustache, the trucker mustache, the clean shaven, back to the beard. He's gone from high socks, low socks. He's gone from realizing that he, you know, took ownership of, you know, one time Astro Jose Abreu's locker and then was like, I need to get the hell out of here. Like he's trying everything. And ultimately, and I'm not really joking when I say this because I believe that there's a little mental side to this. I blame Brian McTaggart. I blame Brian McTaggart because you said you're looking for a stretch and you've been like scouring Baseball Reference page for like these game logs. You're looking for a stretch when Christian Walker has not been ass. Well, there was a 7-game stretch earlier this season where Christian Walker was like hitting above 300, had an OPS of like 895, you know, hit a couple of dingers, was, you know, being productive on and off the field, like, or out, you know, on the field and at the plate. And Brian McTaggart then wrote this lengthy article on MLB.com where he interviewed Christian Walker and was talking about how great of a transition this has been, how much hard work he's put in, how he doesn't want to disappoint his teammates and the Astro fans. And then he went 0-16 with 8 strikeouts and has been like crap since, like with any consistency at the plate. It's just been foobar. So I blame Brian McTaggart.
When when was that? I remember that week that I felt good about Christian Walker.
That one
time. Probably that article that did him in.
Yes.
When I was looking through his splits, just trying to find some time where his OPS was over 700, I finally did find it. He has an OPS of 702 in the last 365 days. So it was immediately the letdown. I saw, 702, which is still below average. But when you include last year, that lifts it up a little bit. But this year, like, you split it up any different way, and he's just been the worst version of himself. He needs to, like, he can quit screwing around with a lot of the whatever, changing his sock height and everything. He needs to sacrifice a goat. There needs to be something done. There needs to be an altar to Jobu or whatever it might need to be. He's got to get serious with this slump busting stuff.
Yeah,
if he means business, if you want to earn your money. If there's a living goat at his household that hasn't been sacrificed yet, I demand to find out about it.
I tell you what, like, slump buster, like, who would be the best Astro he could talk to about the
Bregman.
Best slump buster.
Bregman's really good at, yes.
He's not an Astro anymore.
I hear Bregman's one of the best guys in the world up there in Boston, that he tutors all the young guys. Did you hear, Sean, about the time that he saved Hunter Brown's career? Yeah. That was Alex Bregman.
If
Alex Bregman were around to talk to Christian Walker.
Who's the guy that hit, maybe two nights ago. The guy in Boston, he hit the inside the park homer, and then he hit the grand slam. And then after the game, they were asking him about, like, you know, what do you attribute to the performance and, you know, the bat coming around? You mentioned Alex Bregman. You know, Breggy's been in my corner. Breggy's been that. It's like, son of a gun. Like, what are we doing? Like, we really miss that guy around here.
I know Zach DiCenzo's probably. DiCenzo said that Bregman would like sit with him at the computer breaking stuff down for an hour a day.
Yeah.
Just kind of took him under his wing as a project for him. And But that's neither here nor there. Paredes is doing just fine, so I'm not. It is what it is. Damn it.
Paredes.
I don't know. I don't know who the guy. If you go back to various guys, the really savvy veteran guys that were really great at helping out other guys in the clubhouse. I mean, Beltran was a big one. He didn't just introduce the garbage cans. He brought a lot of other tutelage.
I really want to say Jeff Bagwell right now, but I don't want people to like punch their radios in their car, like. You know, like, you don't hear anything from Jeff Bagwell, but he's very much like that guy, at least as a player. Hasn't really given great advice or, made, if you believe, like, he's making some of the decisions or had made some of the decisions.
There's a big difference between just him hanging around, you know, at batting practice versus making personnel decisions.
Do you think Jeff is, like, waiting in the wings, like, Dana, do I need to get involved here? Like, you want me to take Christian to Florida and, you know, work some things out with him?
I was wondering about that. Yeah, I don't like thinking about it. The biggest thing I didn't like about that whole just Jeff Bagwell, Craig Biggio, Reggie Jackson advisor committee era was just that it had people feeling a certain kind of way about Bagwell that it was uncomfortable. Yeah. It's not, it felt like when two brothers all of a sudden have some kind of a schism in their 40s and then they don't talk to each other for the rest of their lives. Like they're still family, but they can't see it. I felt like the fan base was careening towards that with Jeff Bagwell.
Yeah.
Where you don't like, this is an all time great. This is a Hall of Famer. Like we can't have this venom in our hearts for somebody that you're supposed to love, damn it.
Yeah. That whole committee, it was exciting for about 5 minutes and then it wasn't. Shout out to the 832 from a oldie but a goodie. Says, tell him to call Mark Grace. Talking about Christian Walker as a slump buster. Mark Grace had some good slump busters back in the day, former Cub. Coming up next, we'll take a trip around the NFL. Get you caught up on some news there. It's Sports Radio 610. Stay put. All right. Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning, along with Seth Payne. Good morning, everybody. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up, 713-572-4610. You can text or join the chats via Twitch and YouTube. Appreciate you watching us there. If you have been, take a trip around the NFL. Not a lot going on in the league, but I do think, at least for this first one, pretty interesting to me. I watched an interview with Dan Patrick and Bill Cowher, former Steelers head coach, yesterday on that show. And they were talking about Aaron Rodgers, obviously, with Cowher being a longtime former Steelers head coach. That situation, what does it look like? And we mentioned the Steelers yesterday, Seth. You know, it has some people thinking like they're in the middle. Is this the Super Bowl contending team potentially best case scenario this year for the Steelers, an organization that hadn't won a damn playoff game since 2016? Or are they just going to lead to the demise of Mike Tomlin in his tenure there as Steeler head coach with, I think it's going on like 18 years now. Dan Patrick asked Bill Cowher yesterday if he would ultimately give the keys to the car and total autonomy to Aaron Rodgers. Here's what he had to say.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about it. And I think Aaron's at a point where he knows that, you know, you don't want to be, you know, throwing the ball 40 times a game. I don't think you at this point, you want Aaron Rodgers to be healthy going into the playoffs, and hopefully you get to the playoffs. And I think in the meantime, you've created a balance on your football team and not just relying on his arm throughout the course of four quarters. Listen, you can turn the ball over to him at the end of a half, the end of a game, and know he's been there before, and I think that he will operate that very, very efficiently. Again, I think it's going to be a matter of getting comfortable within this system with the players he has around him.
All right, I was getting confused during his answer because at first I thought he might not know what autonomy is because like everything that he was talking about where, yeah, you don't want him to throw the ball 40 times a game, you want to be able to establish a run game, all of that, that's in stark contrast to the way that Aaron Rodgers sometimes likes to operate. Now, when he talked about at the end of a half or end of a game, where is he going down and running the two-minute drill, then, yeah, do you turn the reins over to him there? I guess that's where the autonomy talk came into it.
Yeah.
I don't think you give him total autonomy to run the offense, because in the past, what Aaron Rodgers has shown he likes to do is be kind of like an antiquated NFL offensive coordinator. Just line my guys up out wide, don't move them around at all, and then we're going to run routes, and then with my super secret relationship with Davante Adams and our little hand signals and everything, that's how we get by. Like, he's not in that situation now. He's not gonna have the time that he did with Davante Adams to form the relationship with DK Metcalf. And he's with an offensive coordinator who really loves to line up with just old school formations and run the ball and set up play action. Mm-hmm. I think it's, if he's got autonomy, it's got to be with all him saying, yeah, but Arthur, you're running the show until we get the 2 minute drill or whatever it might be.
I thought about this because you mentioned yesterday during the show, like, boy, you know, the situation in Pittsburgh with Aaron Rodgers and how Arthur Smith likes to do things versus what Aaron likes to do doesn't exactly feel like there's a mesh point there. And in Bill Cowher saying his guys in that response, he says getting comfortable with other guys around him, that's simple, but apparently hasn't been so easy for him in the past is what my thought was, because when he went to New York, what did he do? He's getting his guys that he played with before in Green Bay. I don't know how many of quote unquote his guys exist in Pittsburgh, and especially when there's a big question mark, like with the play caller and offensive coordinator and Arthur Smith. Do you feel like this is going to be like Jets 2.0 situation for Aaron Rodgers, or is this going to be like a situation where we can't see the forest through the trees kind of a thing?
I don't, it's not going to be Jets like in at least one regard, in that I don't think it'll be the soap opera that it was with the Jets, just because the Jets are so mismanaged on so many levels of the organization, including the owner's sons. It's a clown show in a lot of ways. That's not the case with Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, there's a malaise because that's a city that expects unlike the Jets, that's a fan base that expects championships and expects championship caliber football. They've gotten above average football, but they haven't gotten really great quarterback play. But yeah, the potential for drama is a lot less. I think that with Aaron, it really 100% comes down to, okay, is he going to actually conform to a system for the first time in his career? Everything that made him really good at, as much as he chafed against the Green Bay experience, one of the things that he had for him there was that, yeah, they didn't draft any first-round receivers for him forever, but he had time to work with those younger guys and turn them into either a Randall Cobb or a Devontae Adams or whomever else it might be.
Yeah.
This is him being thrust into a new situation with brand new receivers. He has to basically allow Arthur Smith to run the ship. And I know Steelers fans aren't sold on Arthur Smith as an offensive coordinator. I think that's the potential for drama is going to be between Arthur Smith and Aaron Rodgers.
And
do they see eye to eye?
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch, actually, from the outside looking in.
Yeah, and they both got quirky personality traits. So,
those two
guys, it might be one of those situations where they're both brutally honest dudes, which rubs people the wrong way sometimes,
yeah,
but they might respect each other for it. So maybe they have one of those productively combative relationships.
Did you see this yesterday where the Browns got the okay to build a new stadium? I saw a rendition of their new stadium, and it looks anything but like a NFL football stadium. I don't know what this looks like. It looks like some kind of a institution of higher learning. It's just the gigantic like school of engineering or something like that.
I saw the interior pictures. I thought it looked pretty cool because it was like an all glass ceiling.
Yeah.
So kind of like what the Astrodome was going for back in the day, with more of a before the Astrodome had to turn the panels translucent because outfielders couldn't see. This is actually like clear glass, and it covers the whole top of the field. You're right. It does look like, looking at it from the outside, it does look like a university rec building of some sort.
With a little mid-century modern flair to it. It's just kind of weird with all the different angles.
They probably have a climbing wall somewhere. Yeah.
They got a smoothie bar. They got the approval this week by the Ohio governor. It signed into the budget. A bill that is going to allocate $600 million in unclaimed funds to help build this stadium, which is ultimately going to cost $2.4 billion for the Cleveland Browns.
They can take your unclaimed funds. We've talked about this on the show before, Sean. We've had listeners that have gotten hundreds of dollars because we talked about this. So do you know what unclaimed funds, how that works in a state?
I don't specifically know how it works. I know it exists. I was wondering, one, why I wasn't privy to these unclaimed funds, why they didn't call me.
You're welcome in advance. You are privy to them, but you got to go to, I don't know, search Texas unclaimed funds and be sure you go to the .gov site. And a lot of times either it's because like returned insurance premiums or some class action lawsuit where they couldn't track you down or whatever it might be to give you a reward.
Yeah.
Those sit in the Department of Unclaimed Funds until you go to ask if there are any unclaimed funds for you. So
you're not going to get a call or an email.
Right. So yeah. I'm guessing up in Ohio, they must be saying like, okay, any unclaimed funds before a certain date, we're just going to cut those off and we're going to give them to the stadium.
Good Lord.
So there's going to be a rush to the website up there. But after the show, Sean, you have to do this.
There's going to be a rush to that website down here.
Name.
Yeah.
Yeah. For unclaimed funds.
I'm on it. I'm not joking. Thank you for that. Here's what I got to thinking about is, you know, Texans like practice facility, stadium plans. What do you think the deal is ultimately with this rush to build new headquarters for the Texans? Does this whole thing result in like a renovation to NRG, or do you think they build a new stadium at some point?
It's okay. They're almost definitely going to have a new headquarters, and that'll be somewhere outside of the stadium they're playing in. Wherever, most likely, I'm guessing, unless they end up doing a combo deal. So at the very least right now, when they know they're going to have a new headquarters, maybe it ends up being on a new stadium site or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that we're probably headed towards headquarters / new stadium elsewhere. Ooh. And the headquarters, if they were committed to building a headquarters, they probably would have already maybe started work on it, or they'll be starting work on it this year. But if they're going for something, if you wanted the ultimate, you'd have something like the Star up in at the Cowboys headquarters, but then also have the new stadium right next door.
They've said that's like an inspiration, I think.
Yeah, but the Star isn't at the Star isn't at the stadium site, mm-hmm. so it's separate. I still think it's most likely that they renovate NRG Stadium.
I hadn't heard your
I'd put it at like 53% versus the new stadium.
Well, okay. I mean, that's interesting. I hadn't heard your take on that. I know it's been talked about, in the last few months since they got a new team president and Mike Thoman over there making things happen for the Texans. We'll keep it with the Texans. Rolling into the 8 o'clock hour coming up next. Is this going to be one of the Texans' biggest draft steals in franchise history at the end of the day? We'll discuss next.